Welcome to episode one of the Service Course Report. My name is Ed Philbrick. We're welcomed by Kurt Stockton and Darren Stockton. Service Course is now a podcast, but originally it was an Instagram account and a Substack. So find us on all those essentials. And today we're just going to have a little roundtable chat to get to know us, and so you can have a better idea of what we're going to have coming up in future episodes. So we'll start today with a little intro from Kurt Stockton.
Hey, everybody. Kurt here. Yeah, we thought it would be a good idea just to give you a background of where we came from in cycling, and ultimately that's how we all know each other. Darren and I started riding BMX bikes back before there really were BMX bikes, taking your Schwinn or your bike from Sears and tweaking it a little bit and put some moto handlebars on it and a number plate and doing that, you know. So we grew up racing, riding bikes as our parents rode motorcycles, motocross in the set. Before we were big enough to have motorcycles, we had our BMX bikes and just kind of ripped around at the racetracks. There was a track out by the airport in Santa Barbara near UCSB, which I don't know, there's probably condos or something there now. Haven't been out there in a while.
Yeah.
Mulaney's track. So we did that. You know, kind of fast forward to the late 70s, our family moved over to the Netherlands, what most people know as Holland, and did a little bit of road cycling there just because there are bike paths everywhere. And, you know, you either took the bus or you rode your bike to get around. And that's a country where everybody rides bikes. So we slotted in. And I remember having, you know, back to the motorcycle connection, mom and dad bought these Falcon bikes, English brand bikes, that the motorcycle shop out in Goleta Valley Cycles. Butch Linden had this shop there. They sold bull tacos there, and he's like, oh, I can get some bicycles. So we got some bicycles, you know, old steel bike with Simplex parts and, you know, Regita rims with the little diamonds cut on the sidewalls to try to get those windmills to slow you down, which didn't really work, but, you know, we didn't know any better. So we went for it. Couple years in Holland, and then all three of our paths crossed when we all went to this really cool school in Santa Barbara Middle School. Cycling-based curriculum kind of is what they had. It was unique in that 7th, 8th, and 9th grade. So I went there in 9th grade. Darren and Ed were in 7th, 60 students total. Three grades. That was how they could do these bicycle trips. I mean, and we were out on the wide open roads riding bikes with a whole school full of kids, which you can't even imagine doing that these days. But we got into that. And, you know, from there, we all got into road bikes. It was very road bike centric because that's all you rode back then. You know, we didn't have mountain bikes yet. And we grew out of BMX bikes. So just we got into doing that. And we did these cycling focused trips. And it seemed like it was just kind of a natural progression. We were all kind of competitive. And we got into, you know, like group rides and then racing. And there was a great bicycle club, the Santa Barbara Bicycle Club, which was a race-focused club out of Santa Barbara. And, you know, they had a bunch of these guys, these OGs that we didn't even know it back then, you know, that kind of took us under their wings and taught us how to ride on group rides, you know, taught us how to, you know, to ride a wheel, to keep your elbows bent, to look around, don't slam your brakes on. And it seems like it just kind of snowballed from there, you know. It was, and that's a whole topic for another subject. Yeah. Who's mentoring the new riders coming in? I don't know. I think power meters are. So then we, you know, there was this very robust junior racing scene in Southern California those days. Like, you know, there was no internet. You know, you filled your entry out longhand and mailed it in. And, you know, when we were junior, you had to mail in your entry 2-3 weeks ahead of time, or you wouldn't even get in because the races would fill up. Yeah, so imagine that, races filling up.
Forge your parents' signature.
Forge your parents' signature because you weren't 18. Yeah, maybe once or twice. We got pretty good at that. DS has some stories about that too with the independent studies. But yeah. And so went into that and had success, I would say, as far as like the racing goes. And through a connection, 10-speed drive, a guy named Kent Bostick, who a lot of people know, he was running on the team, kind of by default running this 10-speed drive team as the kind of as a rider or manager. And I got a contract on that team in 85 and you know, I think $500 a month, and got to go race all around the country with those guys for 3 years, you know. During that time, did a little riding with the national team, raced the Baltic Sea Friendship Race, which was a race that was half in Finland, half in Russia, and vice versa, the Soviet Union there. So that was really pretty cool. And then, you know, moved into professional road racing, did my first course states, which was the US Pro Championships back in 1989. It was kind of like recon. I went there, I was like, I always had good endurance. I'm like, I can go do this. So took out a pro license and flew back to Philadelphia and raced that one just to see what it was like to race 156 miles, you know, monument distance, which it still is today. The next year I went back there on a small team that Darren was on and won the pro title, you know, back when, when it was all 7-Eleven and Coors Light and Schwinn, Weedy Schwinn. I think they weren't icy hot at that point anymore, you know? So did that, raced pro road through 93 and then was very fortunate to transition to the golden era of mountain biking, I would call it, you know, when it just blew up. And as a roadie, you know, it's like, oh, you're going to race mountain bikes. You should be a cross country racer. So did that. If you remember back then, or if you don't, most all the races were at altitude. I never really did well at altitude, and there was a lot of climbing. Was racing on that Yeti team, which was the first team, you know, John Parker started that company down in Calabasas, just south of Santa Barbara, and they had a downhill team. Jimmy Deaton was on that team, you know, well, Miles Rockwell.
Wait a second. I think Parker started that in Hendrickson's, like going down in the basement in the basement with Terry, and they were doing stuff they weren't supposed to do down there.
I think that could be possible.
It's legal these days. Yeah, I mean, Parker, you gotta love him and you hate him. We did have a nickname for him, Sparker. Anyway, I mean, it was there, but as we say, remember the factory there, the Yeti factory was just off of the 101 there.
Yeah.
Down in Calabasas. I mean, so he had a downhill team. I was like, wow, look at, they got all these bikes. It'd be fun to do some downhill too. Cause why not? Cause we just did everything back then. You weren't, you know, they were just starting to be downhill athletes, but still did that cross country and got into the downhill. And that was a lot of fun, you know, did that with Yeti, did that with Kestrel. DS and I, you know, we helped start the very first Maxxis mountain bike team in 98. Yep. It's the longest running probably current sponsor in mountain biking today. So we did that, and then, you know, perfectly timed or ill-timed fall, injured my knee, and I transitioned into working on the industry side with Time Sport, the French company that initially had the Time road shoes and pedals, the clipless pedals, the first brand to put white road shoes out there.
The first floating pedal.
And so did a number of years working with the French, which was really, really interesting. Met a lot of interesting people, a long time friendships, you know, and then from there went into team management. Remember, there was a Sierra Nevada cycling team, Sierra Nevada Brewing Company out of Chico. They were a sponsor in 2005. I combined that with Robin Zellner, who brought Kodak along. They had a brand called Ophoto, which was their first kind of go at digital imaging. You know, it was all film before that. Unfortunately, they were good initially, and then they missed that boat. And that ended in 2007. You know, I know I'm rambling on here, but I went into more team stuff there on the road side. Got into event management and promotion. Did that off and on. Got back on the road scene in 2011 and managed the now Novartis women's team. Very successful stint at doing that. 3 years of that team, we had multiple national championships, won a ton of races, had a lot of fun, and I learned a hell of a lot managing a women's team and how much different that is from running a men's team. And then have happened to meet my lifelong partner Robin Farina in that endeavor, and you know, here we are, the two of us, 13 years later. You know, from there, went into some event work. We had a pandemic. All the events got shut down. And so I worked most recently in the industry with, I would say, the biggest manufacturer of bicycle-specific bearings, enduro bearings, and did that until late spring of this year. And along the way, you know, our friendship, I would say, you know, DS has been my friend because he's my brother. And yeah, we fought a lot when we were younger, and till that one time he hit me so hard that I never fought with him again. And then, you know, we've stayed friends with Ed. So yeah, that's it.
Well, I think it might be important to know that you're slightly older than me. I don't know, but just a little bit. But I always learned a lot. You were my mentor in a lot of ways, and got me started in racing in a way, because you kind of paved the way, show how it could be done. I think, you know, I learned a lot of, you know, how to ride from you, and you set a really great example. So,
all right.
Yeah, here.
Very cool.
I'll slide into mine, but I will also start by furthering that as well and say that having an older brother who is already a few years up, you know, 3 years through your teen years, you know, is a lot of, no worries, a lot of developing. But I did learn a lot from Kurt, you know, discipline how to really dedicate yourself to things. So I'll start off and just say, you know, we grew up riding bikes. So I didn't even know, probably started riding at age 3 or 4, you know, 5 in that time. And I do recall one of my first bikes, I had this bike, Shrinky McPinky, because he was small and also pink. We would ride it down the stairs at the house, these outside stairs, and crack it. And my dad would get out the welder and you know, weld it up. And then we'd crack it again until finally, you know, one day the head tube separated from the rest of the bike. And then that was when I got a new bike. But that was kind of our experiences with bikes at the beginning, our old BMX bikes you fixed up. And, you know, a lot of what Kurt went through in his bio is the same for me. You know, we raced BMX, but it was back when you just fixed up your Schwinn. There were no, quote, BMX bikes, you know, unquote, yet that were specifically designed for it. You know, we grew up in the foothills of Montecito, and it was really rural up there. There were trails between the roads. So we were always on bikes after school, you know, just jumping things, putting plywood jumps in the driveway. That's just what we were doing, you know, and our parents had got into riding dirt bikes at the same time and racing those. And so we got dirt bikes as well. And we were just riding two wheels. You know, we pack up and go out to the races on the weekend, go out to the desert, which was a lot of fun, you know, camping with your friends and riding bikes. And then,
I would say too, you know, talking about the BMX part, and it was like, well, there were so many kids in our neighborhood. It's like, our house seemed like it was the place. Like we had this long downhill driveway and, you know,
yeah, natural
big sheets
elevation.
Of plywood, had a little elevation, stacked the bricks up, and we'd make jumps. It's like, who could jump as far? We would build BMX tracks around the house, you know, and everybody would come over and do that. It was like, yeah, we would do that and then go on adventures too. But it was, it was a great little group of friends there.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, Montecito was an incredible area. We should remember that it's like the birthplace of a lot of vertical skateboarding, the T-holes. After the Sycamore Fire, there was a lot of burned out swimming pools.
Yeah.
You know, we always think of Venice and Dogtown, but Montecito was like, there was the hippie culture on Mountain Drive blending with the wealthy culture of Montecito.
Skate culture.
There were some pretty amazing kids and doing some pretty amazing things that are really, you know, very influential. Powell Skateboard started right there.
Yeah, Powell Sims, you know, Tom Sims was a friend of ours. I mean, Abe Powell, I went to school with, who was the son, you know, of the creators of Powell and Powell Peralta. So yeah, there was definitely a rich area in terms of a lot of things, not monetarily rich, just in terms of culture and things going on. So as we got out of that era, moved over to Holland for a couple of years, as my brother had mentioned. And it's funny, I can remember we had those Falcon road bikes and they were just getting around. That was it. You know, we would go over and watch motorcycle races. We went to some European GPs, and I remember this one time we're on our way to one of the GPs and we pull up and all of a sudden there's a quick stop and everything. We're like, what's going on? And a bike race goes by. You know, like they stopped us. But as soon as the bike race went by, we were like, okay, whatever. We're thinking about dirt bikes, you know? So it is funny that for all those years in Holland, I never even considered racing a road bike. I can remember the very last baseball practice that I had. The fields were up a little bit north of our house and the wind blew south. I was riding home from practice and I was on the flats and I was going. And I remember getting to a point where I kept shifting the right lever, you know, the rear, and had gotten all the way down. But I had such a tailwind, or maybe I was getting older, stronger, that, you know, I had finally run out of gear. I didn't ever remember that happening. So I'm looking down at my bike. I'm like, huh, I wonder what that left lever does, which means I had been riding that bike for 2 years in Holland and never had it in the big chainring. And so I remember reaching down those old Simplex shifters and just dialed in the big gear. And I was like, yeah. So, you know, that was about the extent of my performance cycling when we lived over in Holland. But when we came back, we started up at Santa Barbara Middle School, which is where I met Ed in seventh grade. And we've been, you know, best of friends ever since. And that was a lot of fun because we really started doing some longer bike trips. And I noticed that for being in seventh grade and being one of the younger ones, I was usually, you know, after, you know, my brother Kurt and a couple of his friends that were good, you know, Ed and I would be like the next ones in, you know, in front of everybody. And so in Santa Barbara, we had such a strong racing scene. And back then, really, road bikes, my headphones are sliding. Sorry about that. Back then, road bikes, I think, were about the only bikes you could race, you know, that weren't BMX bikes. Got into racing road bikes. And then once I got into the racing bug, I mean, that was, you know, fast and furious. There was tons of races. There was a program you could do. You're trying to get to national championships. And so I raced road bikes and ended up, you know, in junior racing, several top fives at national championships, was on the Raleigh junior team, which was kind of like the team that battled it out with the 7-Eleven team, which was admittedly the best junior team, those guys. But we definitely had our fair share of good days against them. And so then from getting out of juniors and getting into elites, you know, I was racing like many people that make that transition and was having some decent success at racing. I was also looking at going to film school at UCLA, and I'd interviewed at Brooks Institute of Photography, which was in Santa Barbara. And then through a good friend of ours, Shelley Versus, who was the partner of Phil Anderson at the time, I got a chance to head out and go race over in Europe. So I took out a pro license. Raced over there that season, didn't end up getting a contract, but I came back and raced another 3 years. That would have been like 90, 91, 92 on the road in America. Helped my brother win the pro championship, which that'll be a good longer story for another pod. And then, you know, raced on the Chevrolet LA Sheriff team for a couple of years, was able to get, you know, podiums at national series events, podium at the stage of a Tour DuPont, won a national series event in Freehold, and then ended up making the switch into mountain biking. And again, Kurt had raced a bit more of cross country before me, had been in the mountain bike scene, but I knew pretty quick, we went out and did the Cactus Cup, and I'm like, man, this isn't even a mountain. I'm not a cross country racer. And so I was really excited about the idea of downhill, and that was a lot of fun racing downhill. You know, I think I did 7 or 8 years national and then World Cup circuit, and ended up leading into other career ventures at the end of that time when I was racing downhill. You know, I made it was a national team member a couple of times, including my last year, you know, getting to race the world championships. And I raced for Maxxis, and we had built that team, Kurt and I, along with Kathy Sessler. We were all kind of individuals on that team. And we had all got together one off season before that 98 year and said, you know, we should all have the same sponsors, the same jersey. And we really put it all together, the three of us, and made what became the Maxxis team, which, like Kurt said, ran for, I don't know, as that team entity itself, 20 something years, I think, it had gone on. But the mountain biking was really interesting. I got into product design and specifically tire design at a junction of time that I was able to slide into, and designed a bunch of tires for Maxxis and the original High Roller, and really the tires that allowed them to start sponsoring people in downhill, which led to their kind of current reign in the tire era. But that was really fun and led to design and development jobs after cycling for me. After I got out of racing downhill, I took a job being the head of design and manager for Intense Tires. Their cycle brand had a tire brand for a lot of years. And I did that for a while, but I really missed kind of the athlete life. And where I was living down in Temecula, I ended up getting an opportunity to get into being a trainer in professional motocross, and really, really got into doing that right after I got racing. The same year, I started what would become the Santa Cruz Syndicate team. The first year, it was a joint venture with Santa Cruz Bicycles and the Intense Tires brand. I really did it as a way to promote the tire brand that I was running. And the following year, I stopped working at the tire brand, and Rob, the owner of Santa Cruz, just came to me and was like, dude, let's really make a team. And that was amazing. That was when the full weight of Santa Cruz got behind it. And, you know, it became officially the Syndicate, and ran that for another 2 years before, you know, which would have been 4 and 05 as the Syndicate, which that team still, you know, is competing today. And Jackson Goldstone's won the last 3 World Cup downhill. So it's pretty cool to know that entity that I started is still one of the top teams in the game, you know, started with Santa Cruz. And then I got into professional motocross training and just kind of had, I think, just spent enough time in bicycles for a while and was looking for something different but new in terms of motocross. And man, they were really behind in physical preparation and training at that point. And I was so interested because I've been racing downhill, and then you get into motocross and it's a sport with tons more technology and money. And so I'm like, oh man, I can't believe all the stuff, you know, they've got going on. And that really set up a career, you know, post competing for myself, where I have focused on product design and then athlete or people training. You know, at first it was all professional athletes, and then I relocated back up to my hometown of Santa Barbara and opened my own training business, and have basically been doing that in product design ever since. My business moved down to Carpinteria a couple of years ago. I like it down here. It's a little more beach town vibe, not so packed and busy. And there's amazing gravel riding about 45 seconds right from my door. I can get right out onto the Carp Bluffs and ride out there. So that was kind of the evolution of my cycling and going into business. Yeah.
So I think it's important to back up just a little bit.
Yeah.
Some people may not know Phil Anderson, and he was a remarkable, he was probably the first English-speaking writer to wear the yellow jersey.
Yeah, he was.
Probably in 80, maybe 79, 80.
Maybe the 80 tour. Yeah, 79 or 80 tour. He's first writer to win, an English-speaking writer to win a classic, the Amstel Gold.
Yeah, you know. So you stagiaireing or whatever you want to pronounce the word for him was a remarkable moment. Also, I don't think Phil Anderson ever shifted out of his big chain ring.
Yeah, that's for sure.
I think he grew up in his big chain ring. He was the most oxen-powered strength training rider that I ever had the privilege of sitting behind for a brief moment. He was incredibly strong. I know Kurt ran into him at the Handmade Bike Show, and you know, people don't even realize that they're next to a true pioneer, maybe even more than LeMond or Jacques Boyer. You know, he was an incredible pioneer for taking cycling out of Europe, launching it in Australia, launching it around the rest of the world.
Absolutely. And one interesting thing about him I want to add in too is, you know, that year, and I think I have my dates right, when he was when he won Amstel Gold, I believe was 83, and he was in that Peugeot team. And, you know, pro cyclists back then, most of them were making like hardly any money, 20, 30 grand a year. I mean, ridiculously, that's what Phil was making, and won a classic. And I remember him telling me it was a big deal when he went back into his team to renegotiate. And he went to Peugeot and he said, you've got this guy who you're marketing around and you're selling, you know, blah, 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 making all this money off. Do you realize that you pay him the same amount? And he went in with a lawyer and pointed over to a woman working in the office. They knew the salary and said, basically, you're paying him the same as her. And they all kind of went, oh. And he was the first guy that really got a big bump up for one of the big bumps for rider salaries that helped LeMond and, you know, and people to follow. So he was, aside from his cycling like aggressiveness, that guy was just not scared, you know, to lean in and go for it and stand up for what he wanted. I learned a lot being around him. That was a really cool experience.
Yeah. When he was on Peugeot, they weren't even behind him. He was like making his own way on that team.
Yeah.
Like,
well, English speaking back then wasn't like it is today. You know, you were kind of like the castaway, really, until 7-Eleven. And even after them, they were still the cowboys. But
yeah. Well, and it was, Ed, you touched on, you know, running into Phil last summer at the Handmade Show up in Portland. And I saw him walking by and his back was to me and I knew it was him. Because his legs look exactly the same, like he's just still been in the big ring the last 45 years, whatever. Yeah, turned around and he still loves riding bikes. And it was just like, hey, KS. It was like no time had passed. So
yeah he's a good dude.
Yeah, that was fun
for sure.
To see him,
so. Well, you know, I think one of the remarkable things that, you know, our audience will get to learn about UDS is that you're an engineer by heart. Your dad was truly an engineer, and
right.
I remember you helping me fix my Mathis brake pads that had fins on them in the basement of your shop, of your house. And I think that, you know, attention to detail, engineering mindset, your design work, and then you learned about the human body and how design and the human body blend together and you bring in the bicycle. And I think you're really onto something. I know Specialized, you know, has come a long way with body geometry and stuff.
Right.
But I think that integrating the bicycle and the body together is one of your absolute fortes.
Thank you. Yeah.
I think that's a discussion too for the, for another podcast.
Definitely.
Right? UCI's all worried about speed and they're putting all these rules in and they're not thinking about, you know, what's the most important factor here? The riders. It's not the equipment, it's the riders, man. So
Yes. You know, one thing I wanted to go over as I was looking up at my bio notes here too, is I, you know, had a note up here about how I'd started the Santa Cruz Syndicate, you know, with Rob Roscott, built it with him at Santa Cruz. And I ran it for 3 years. 05 was my last year running it. And then they took it in-house. But the interesting thing is the very next year, Kurt's team, which I think then it was Ophoto Sierra Nevada for 06 or Kodak Gallery, whatever it was
Kodak
called.
Kodak Gallery. They changed the name. Yeah.
Yeah. They were, his road team was the first team sponsored by SRAM when SRAM launched their road parts. And the Syndicate was also a SRAM team. And I had been sponsored by, you know, SRAM RockShox when I was a racer. And so when I went to build a team, we looked at first about, I tried to keep, you know, sponsors, you know, that I had had in my racing career. And I remember Kurt calling me up after, which was in 06. Now I had just stopped running the Syndicate, but he had his road team up there, and the Syndicate was the team that they'd brought up as their top tier mountain bike team. And he was thinking to himself, he called me up to Mark, like, that's pretty cool that, you know, the two of us as brothers basically had those two teams, which were flagship teams that SRAM was using to highlight their product. So that's just one of those unknown, but I guess feather in the caps, you know, for development. And when you talk about giving back to the sport and, you know, as racers, so many people help us out, give us free parts, give us money, help you out, give you a ride. And so I feel like being able to run a team is a cool part of that. But then to have it be, you know, those top teams was a pretty neat jewel. Yeah. Yeah,
I think I remember they at Sea Otter that year in 2006, SRAM did a launch of that Force Road Group. But we had, I think both of us were there at that launch because you had the Syndicate there as well. That was at one of those venues down on the water in Monterey where we did that. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, and you two brothers were there for the launch of Time in the United States, and now SRAM owns Time. They can't quite figure out how to launch that brand, and I think they need to make their riders ride the pedals. And I'm wondering, SRAM, like, what are you doing with Time? I noticed slowly that, you know, more and more of the SRAM athletes are on Time, but
I've noticed you guys learned more as well.
You guys learned a lot watching, you know, the launch of Time in the United States, and, you know, now SRAM owns them.
I mean, I remember going over there and setting up, you know, going early season over to Mallorca with the guys who ran all the promotion in France and working with the Banesto team. And, you know, Tony Rominger was on Cofidis and trying to get these guys to switch over. You know, there were special cleats that Time made that didn't rotate for, we called it the Indoran cleat, the Cam Indoran, you know, and working with those guys. It's all that behind the scenes stuff. You know, you got to make some tweaks, but, that was that company. Yeah, we have a lot there. I mean, even when I was sponsored with them, Ed, I remember when three of us were roommates and we both had the same size feet at that time, except like half size smaller, my left than my right, and you were half size smaller, right than left. So Time would send me two pair of shoes for every one. And then I got new shoes, Ed got new shoes
yeah. too.
And at the end of the season, we'd put them back together and sell them at the bike swap meet.
That's right. So, well, segueing into Ed here, why don't you give us your bio rundown, Ed?
Yeah, so I started riding bikes in probably 1980. My brother was, you know, sort of a 70s hippie cyclist, and he might have gone to Research Park a few times and gotten dropped. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I started riding in 1980. You know, quickly we went to Santa Barbara Middle School where, you know, we would do some 50-mile days. So when you're 12 and 13 and 14 years old, that's a pretty serious endeavor, especially on the equipment that we had. I remember I had this, like, Kirkland handlebar bag thing was huge. I had, like, you know, rocks in there basically. So anytime I see someone with a large bag, I cringe and think of all the extra weight and the distress on one's body. So started riding in 1980, Santa Barbara Middle School. Probably my first race was the Columbus Day Criterium, fall of 1983. I probably got dropped, but still finished in the top 10, you know. So that was like a, you know, kind of a big moment. From there, kind of locked in with you guys and doing the junior scene. I went to the Olympic Training Center three times on, like, the junior development program, finished top 10 in the nationals. I think ultimately I won three or four state championships, a lot of them on the track. One of them is a master, but I went to track nationals. In 87, I went and raced in Brittany, which, you know, I was probably the only English-speaking guy except for Greg Orvets in Paris and Jacques Boyer. That was quite a learning experience there. You know, you would race four times a week for $8 a day, and you would follow basically the carnival and never drive more than 45 minutes. It was mafia-style racing, so you either packed fish or raced your bike, and so they wanted to split that money. And so teams from opposing jerseys and different teams would be splitting the money on the edge of town at the gas station. So you're like, oh, now it all makes sense why the race played out the way it did.
Right.
So,
why that guy was helping that guy when it didn't seem to make sense at the time. I think you also learned the power of the mid-ride espresso when you were over in Brittany, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, that's a story for another day. My bike got taken off the train and I had to drink coffee for the first day to make it back through the rain. It was actually the day that Greg LeMond was shot. I was avoiding a bonk and had my first coffee. Bernard Hinault's mechanic came ripping through the town, and the guy I was riding with goes, "That's Hinault's mechanic." He goes, something's up. And that was the day that LeMond was shot. And I think in recent times we've realized how close to death Le Mans actually was. And
yeah, minutes.
So that whole team was a buzz in Brittany that day. And I was just trying to get home in the rain.
Right.
I wonder if his mechanic was Alain Decois at that time, because I worked with Alain at time. And yeah, he was Eno's mechanic.
Chef.
I think it was. Eno's mechanic was quite a legend, I'm pretty sure. I know he was the best in the world at the time, so I'm sure he had the best mechanic.
I know that Decois was good, because when I stayed at his house when I worked for time, he had Eno's Giro winner's trophy sitting on the mantle in his living room. So, yeah, there was a relationship there for sure.
Yeah. So I returned to the United States and I raced Pro 1-2 all around Super Week. I probably raced and finished Redlands 5 times, which I'm pretty proud of, because some of those years are Raul Alcala, Jock Boyer, Davis Finney, the original Dutch Mafia from Southern California, in my opinion. If you remember those 80s racers, those guys were good. Then I kind of struggled at racing back of the pack, ended up opening a bike shop in Santa Barbara called Summerlin Cycles, which I ran for 4 years with a gentleman named John Jones, Jones Wheels, who recently passed away. And we did some innovative things that I see, have kind of played out in the cycling world, where cycling has gone a little more boutique-y and a little more high-end, fancier. I think we were kind of early to some of that.
Coffee in there for things like that, It sounds funny now, but back then people were like, wait, coffee in a bike shop? What?
Yeah, we had a Coke machine on the deck, and I think it was 25 cents for a Coke. We lowered the price intentionally for the machine.
And your shop was right on the main route going north-south from Santa Barbara. If you're going to go down to Carpinteria or Ventura or Santa Paula or ride down to L.A., there's only one road, and you rode right by Summerlin Cycles, both directions.
Yeah,
our best days was the day when that Century would go on in the San Ynez Valley. I forget what that thing was called. It ran for many years, and that's when I started to realize that cycling was growing, when I would see all these people from LA coming up to ride an event in the San Ynez Valley, and they would all stop in our shop. I forget what that Century was called. Maybe it was
Solvang Century, I think.
Century. Yeah, I always think of the Solvang Century as like the original Fondo, and this whole explosion of cycling for everybody. So eventually I was pulled in other directions. I worked for International Triathlon Tour. I worked for two different sports agencies, one that was focused on fitness and triathlon. And then I worked for a professional golf agency. We signed Rich Beem, who won the PGA championship. And he, we did his Callaway contract, got him out of jail when he got a DUI at the British Open in the middle of the night.
That's going to be tough in Britain.
Yeah. All that kind of like sports agency relationship stuff comes from things that I learned from actually you two guys, in a way, like just, taking care of sponsors, customer service, building relationships.
Right.
I think when you guys both brought up the SRAM stuff and the syndicate stuff and all the relationships that you've had, that's just an important skill that I really learned from you guys. It's important. I see the young kids doing it now, but, they're doing it by posting. I think also they need to talk to people, but anyway.
Yeah.
So
all three of us fathers of young kids. Yeah, we can see that, right? Nothing's more important than face to face.
Yeah, there's a young U23 rider in town, Luke Pankowitz, that I'll call out. He just made it onto the Lifetime Grand Prix U23. I'm real proud of him. Proud of him. He did that at Sea Otter, just toughing it out. And at first he wouldn't talk to me, like I engage with him on social media, and I'm like, I just keep talking to him. I go, you got to practice talking to me, because if you want to be good, you got to be able to talk to somebody in their 50s. So
Yeah. That's a good point.
Anyway, after that, I worked for different brand development projects, Roadrunner Sports, doing running products. Then I was away from cycling for 25 or 30 years, depends how you count. And then I got dragged back in when the Belgian Waffle Ride went right by my house and I could hear it going by. And me and my daughter went down and helped direct traffic. And so I've finished the waffle 3 times. I've done about 4 wafers. Michael Marks has been a big inspiration to me. He, you know, I would never ride bikes again if it wasn't for his creation of blending road and cyclocross, something that I grew up enjoying. And today I'm a realtor in North County, San Diego. I've created the Realtor on Bike Network, which is a network of realtors around the country that are cycling focused. Jürgen Benneke, I think I'm saying his name. He's now an agent on the East Coast. So I got different agents around, agents in Florida, Bend, Oregon, Portland, that, you know, either used to race or just ride bikes, trying to build up a network of agents that we can share ideas and refer clients to each other. So if you know somebody that wants to move to Bend, Oregon, who wants to be on a cycling trail, find an agent that helps, understands that cycling is the new golf.
Nice.
So that's my story.
All right.
Well, definitely our Santa Barbara connection. You know, I just saw a message come through that actually went through to the three of us from old time Santa Barbara guy, Mike Hecker. And he just said that, he heard Jim Hopperstedt just passed away. So
yeah,
Santa Barbara Bike Smiths.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's a sad one.
Yeah.
Another one of the, one of the great people we met in Santa Barbara through cycling. Yeah.
You know, funny story about Hopperstedt. When I was living in Santa Barbara and racing downhill for Maxxis, I would pop into a shop and buy a few parts here and there that I couldn't get through sponsorship, mainly Shimano pedals, you know, or if I was building wheels, you know, he seemed to have the right length spokes. And so I was like, man, I'd love to sponsor you, you know, and get on your bike or something. Like, what do you think you can do? And I was like, man, you know what I could really use help with is building wheels. And I'm like, I get all the hubs, I get the parts, you know, if you could help me with the spokes and that would be like awesome. And so he's like, oh yeah, I can do them all. You know, it's downhill wheels, and like downhill wheels, they don't last long, you know, they get beat up. And this was in the era where we started going so fast in downhill, and the suspension hadn't quite caught up. So we were getting a lot of flat tires on rocks and stuff. And so the only way we figured out not to get flats is we would run really soft rims. So, you know, if you would hit what would normally be like a pinch strike far before tubeless, the side of the rim would just bend out of the way, and you go down after training and kind of straighten it out with a crescent wrench for a training wheel, right? And Santa Barbara is notoriously rocky for anybody who hasn't ridden mountain bikes here, and a couple of trails, tunnel trails especially. I mean, I would start off with a training wheel, and all I ever did, it seemed like, was tighten spokes, because you'd be going down and boom, you get one big rim ding, you know, that would push it in, so you'd have to tighten that spoke up. And so I told Jim, yeah, you know, if you can build me all my wheels for the year, then we got a deal, you know, gave him a nice big Bike Smith sticker on. And so he built me my first set of wheels, and it was just like he was so proud of this master craft of work and everything. And I just felt bad for him. And I brought it back in like a month later. I'm like, all right, I need to get another one built up. And he was just like, what? You know, like shocked. You know, you build a road wheel, you might see that person in a couple of years. And so I think I got the better deal out of that one, because he didn't really realize what he was in for. And I had enough hubs that I would cycle him through, you know, bring him wing sets, something like that. So it was pretty funny. So he definitely built me a lot of wheels that year, but he's a good dude. A lot of funny stories, Hopperstedt.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was one of the last people that, like, he ran a bike shop by himself. And I remember when his bike shop was over on like Santa Barbara Street and Coda or something.
Yeah.
He just had boxes of stuff, and everything, it was cataloged in his head. Like, you asked him where something was, and he would just go back. You just see him rummaging through boxes, and he'd pull it out. And then something else. And it was just like, we were like, man, if anyone ever had to find anything else in here, they couldn't do it without him. Yeah. He was definitely the very last of a kind person. So,
yeah.
And just a very kind person.
And then he also kept all the daily cash and everything in a fanny pack. Like on the front, right there, like in his pouch, like the cat with it, what, you know, anything that was over what was in the register, it was right in there. Maybe it was a shady part of town or something, but he kept his cash close.
Well, he had some other stories too about,
he bought all the closeout inventory from Summerlin Cycles out of a warehouse, the warehouse that's probably now the bike path there in Summerlin.
Oh yeah. Yeah. That is funny. So, well, cool. Well, as we're looking over at some different things to talk about, we were maybe thinking about updating into what our current riding is and current bikes and kind of our vibe on that. I think, I don't know if Ed, we want to go reverse. You could start with that.
Yeah. I got an endurance road bike from Canyon and rode that for most of my Belgian waffle endeavors. Now I have a more legitimate Canyon Grail gravel bike, needs a little more clearance, but I got that. And then I have a pure road bike. I ride a climbing canyon, Canyon Ultimate.
Nice.
I love that bike, probably because it's flexi and compliant, maybe.
Yeah, possibly.
Versus an aero bike. Then I recently got a mountain bike, which, you know, my back doesn't seem to totally vibe with. It's just an interesting endeavor. This weekend, tomorrow, I'm going to do the Kevin Lentz, Lentz's Moore ride from Cadence in Encinitas. To Escondido. It's a 50-mile road ride. It says no drops, and I'm thinking that's hilarious. And no surges. Oh, no surges.
Yeah, like, right.
Like, that's going to happen. But we're riding to the point where he was killed in Escondido. Hmm. There's a little memorial there, and you know, he was 37 years old, and he had a young baby, and he was killed by he wasn't intoxicated. The guy was on bad drugs, and he was on the wrong side of the road on a descent out of Daly Ranch.
Oh man!
And you know, there's the Lentz's Moore category in Belgian Waffle, and that is if you can ride it on your mountain bike, that's the Lentz's Moore award. Ah,
nice.
And so that's be my ride tomorrow. I'll probably have to rest my body today to do that tomorrow, but,
yeah.
That's what I got going on. How about
Man's
you, Cass?
Man's got to know his limitations.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, I am a drop bar rider, gravel, mostly gravel. I still get out on my road bike every once in a while. So I've got a couple of versions of a custom titanium gravel bike. Gravel frame set I got through Haley Cycles, a brand run by a guy named Ming Tan, who's a longtime industry person up here in NorCal. I did a little sales repping for Ming about 10, 12 years ago, and he started his boutique brand. And so I played with a couple of different geometries, and I really got my geometry dialed on the gravel bike. So a lot of gravel riding up out of Nevada City, you know, maybe not quite 45 seconds, like from DS's studio. He's on the bluffs in Carpinteria.
Yeah.
But, you know, I can leave the house here and, you know, within 10 or 15 minutes, I can be on dirt and literally you can ride all day, never see a signal, you know, and just go and go. I've become a big fan of the mullet setup. So single ring up front, mountain bike gearing in the back. In Western Nevada County, you're either going uphill or downhill.
Yeah,
unless you're on the we have a nice little network of irrigation ditches from the gold rush era, you know, as they irrigation, but they also moved water for the mining, and those are all on a 1 or 2% grade. So if you want to ride flat, you go ride the ditches for a little bit. So do that, and doing that, and then I do have a road bike. I have a Ventum NS1, which is their road frame. My partner Robin, she runs the Seneca Cycling Team. They were sponsored by Ventum for a couple of years, so I bought one of their frames to support them, but mostly because I'm pretty particular on my bike fit, and their standard geometry was pretty darn close for me, so it worked. You know, ultimately, I'm a custom geometry guy, but, you know, as I've talked with DS and both of you guys, you know, the gravel bikes are going to these long center to front bikes.
Finally.
You know, with these super stubby stems. And for me, it's like, I'm perfect. And then I can just put like a normal length stem on and ride these bikes. So I am, I should have a new gravel bike here in the next couple of months. And, you know, we can talk about that then. But yeah, haven't been on a mountain bike in quite some time. Probably when I do, it's going to, you know, may very well be an e-bike because, as DS says, it's, you know, kind of that halfway between mountain bike and a motorcycle, but you don't have to worry about oil and gas.
That's it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. So I'm riding, I really ride gravel bike and mountain bikes. My body kind of timed out of the aggressive road cycling position. COVID helped that along just because I was rotating through different, sorry about that, people. I was rotating through different bikes and had my mountain bike in my van, my gravel bike at the house, and my road bike down at my work. And work got shut down for several months with all the lockdowns. And by the time I got back down to my studio and rode my road bike again, I was going, man, my seat sure feels awful high on this. My cleats feel like I'm up on my toes. My bar is really, really low. And I think at the same time as I'm 56, it just started a shift of body adaptability. You know, we tend to lose a bit of mobility over time and a bit of flexibility. And I found through some old kind of injuries and wear patterns that I needed to get off the road bike, but still love road bikes, still love watching road cycling, even have a pair of wheels I throw in my gravel bike with road tires on them and go ride it. But I mostly stick to the dirt, and I just, I really have found, you know, in Santa Barbara area, it's got more and more crowded. And so the road cycling, you know, there's a lot more cars and things like that. And as I pushed out into riding dirt, and I still do product design, tire design for Panaracer mountain bikes and in gravel tire design. And so that's kept me out on the dirt. But I can get out and away from people and away from cars and get out. And then also, you know, I can jump, I can slide, I can do fun things that reminds me of my youth. So it's kind of funny, my riding over the last several years has, in part through old computers, you know, breaking and stuff, but I've really kind of detect my riding. I don't have any power meters on. If I have a computer, sometimes I just throw it in my pocket. I'll track my data, but I'm not really watching it, and do rides a little bit more that it's like, can I make it up this hill without dabbing, as opposed to looking what my wattage is, just kind of where my, you know, where it's, where my cycling has come around to. So my current two bikes, my business that I have in Santa Barbara, I'm like a specialty retailer, and I started selling Mondraker bikes a little over a year ago. For people who don't know, they're a little bit smaller, Spanish brand, big in Europe, been around for 20 years, just smaller in America, but they make some really great bikes. And so I bought an E-Enduro mountain bike last summer, and then I got one of their new Air gravel bikes this spring in February. And those are the two main bikes that I've been riding. So I really love those bikes. And I can't say enough about the quality of their bikes and how they build them and how they just put them all together. I've been really impressed with those. But yeah, gravel and my e-mountain bike are my two main jams right now.
DS is kind of my cycling conscious. On one shoulder, I have reliving my youth. And on the other shoulder, I have DS reminding me how stupid that is.
About cycling position or things like that. Or, well, we were talking the other day about position. And I told him how a couple years ago, I'm like, all right, I just kind of had to say, I'm in this for the long game. I, you know, form check with is our term we always use. If you're riding along and you see a mirror on the side, a mirrored window or something, you give a quick look over. And of course, you kind of bend your elbows a little bit more and get a little bit lower, so your form check looks good. But I kind of had to give up on that old form check look. And we were, Ed and I were kind of laughing, having a phone convo, talking about how, God, really, I'm going to raise my bars up a half centimeter or something. You know, I won't be as air. I won't be this. It's like nobody notices anymore, you know, if you're bent over into arrow, but I couldn't do it anymore. So yeah, that's why I ended up with the higher position.
Well, you notice, because when you get done riding, your body feels all right.
Yeah.
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 You're fast when you're comfortable.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, it's the old adage, you know, you're not as good as you once were, but you're as good once as you ever were.
Yeah.
You know, you make those shifts. I was like, I'm in it for the long game. I don't care if I go quite as fast up any particular hill on a ride. I just want to be able to go out and do all the rides that I want to do and then come back and feel good, go out for a hike with my daughter or something afterwards. So
yeah, for me, I was like always trying to relive and find peak performance and like try and prove things. I'll be honest, I'm a very ego-driven rider. So I'm always trying to like catch up with the board shorts and pass them.
Right.
You know, I've got something to prove. But then I realized like constantly trying to relive my youth, achieve better performance, ride faster, you know, get back to maybe even a little bit of masters racing, things like that. Or if I get hurt, then suddenly I can't ride my bike at all.
Yeah.
So what's important for me is like just being able to go out for a ride is important. So I can't take that away, but I can take away, I can survive taking away the pursuit of performance. You know what I mean?
Like, yeah. Well, unfortunately our bodies, I mean, unless you're starting off really, really out of shape, you know, we're not like wine. We don't get better with time. I tell people just in the health coaching and training business, you know, that they ask me, well, what's your long-term plan for health? I'm like, you have everything that you have right now and you have to fight every day to hold on to it, you know, which is the truth, right? For whatever that is. And so, so I agree. You know, you have to look at what your new parameters are. Just like I said, it used to be maybe putting out this wattage, but now it's like, I want to go out and do this ride. You know, I'm going to do 3 hours. I want to feel good. I want to feel solid going up and down. I want to, you know, whatever it is, I want my skills to be good, you know, my skill set to feel good. I think that's why I like riding on dirt. It's just because, you know, I mean, I grew, you know, all the years that I raced downhill and then ran the syndicate and then been involved in motocross training, dirt has been such a big part of my riding. And there's such a different skill set to that once you get off pavement on the dirt that for me, that's, you know, that's really exciting. That's kind of like a joy of my riding, to have fun, just applying just enough back brake to get your back end to step out a little bit, to open up your corner a little more, and then let it off perfectly to get the back end to stick and go through. That's like my joys that I find out when I'm riding.
Yeah, I was recently recovering from a back injury and some friends said, hey, we're doing a Tuesday night taco ride. And I'm like, well, I don't think I'm quite ready for that. But anyway, I joined them on mountain bikes. The first time I've been on a mountain bike ride, and we stopped like 10 times. My back loved the stops. And then we ended up at the local bar. It's called Vine and Tap. And on the wall, there's a chrome bumper from the Yellow Truck, which is the Yellow Truck Trail. So it's a bar that's like a vintner store that's embraced cycling. Where was I going with this? I lost my train of thought. So anyway, the point was, on that ride was Jason Richardson. He was like world champion BMX racer. JD, Jeremiah Dean, he raced downhill with your generation. And we were all like having fun and stopping, and like we had tacos afterwards. And I go, wow, if you took this away from me, I'd really, you know, I should be able to preserve this versus trying to finish a Masters 55 plus criterium.
Absolutely. And I think that that's for me also, like, what, like, I enjoy so much about riding is as fun as I can have by myself. You know, there's nothing like, and especially when you're on dirt, riding with your buddy, seeing him pitch the back end out and just bring it back in or something. Oh, you know, we were out, I was out riding with three friends over the weekend, and we were talking, we're all on e-bikes, you know, enduro bikes, mountain bikes. We were talking about how much we love riding. And I said, what are the other areas of your life that you find yourself just like being able to not control, just like screaming for joy when you do something? And that's what we hear coming down the trail, go through a section. And, you know, as you guys both know, Jim White, but, you know, one of my best buddies, and I just hear him, you know, behind me, and I'm doing the same thing. You hit a section, it just feels good, you know, got to get that out. So that's a really fun part.
It's interesting, right? Riding bikes when you're first a kid, that sense of freedom, when all of a sudden you can go much further than you did when you walked. You could explore that much further from the house and get home, right? And it was like, wow, it opened up this new world. And here we are, you know, over four decades later, and it's still the same, right?
That joy. Still love riding.
That
is the key.
My happy place.
But I think that we all still have opinions about the modern racing world, and some of our greatest side conversations are those. Recently we chatted a little bit about the UCI rules and their effort.
The aero rules.
Well, their effort to try and make racing safer. And I think, you know, in future episodes, we'll dig a little deeper into those topics, but I think our listeners would like to hear us riff a little bit on the UCI rules before this topic gets too stale. One of the things that I think really needs to happen is the promoters need to just make safer races. I know traffic furniture is a, you know, a big problem in Europe, and we saw the bumps in the road that took out Remco and Jonas and all those guys last year, you know, and maybe it's technology on the head unit that alerts the riders that there's a turn coming up, or better signage, but this whole effort to slow down the racing by gear restrictions and no deep rims and no narrow handlebars, I think is, you know, something maybe we should chat about for a second.
I agree. It's a deep topic, but I think that the stab that they're taking at it at aerodynamics is, you know, one very small piece of it. I mean, you can coast down a hill faster than you can spin any gear out, as with the case that took out Remco and Jonas last year for getting the name of the race in Spain. And that doesn't have anything to do with the gearing that you're in. I think that some of the changes that they made in the bike in terms of tube width or deep wheels, while they're saying that's for aerodynamics and speed, I really think that that might, whether they meant to or not, address more of the topic, which is just that the bikes don't handle as well. And there's a whole bunch of reasons for that. You know, this is probably another longer topic as well. But, you know, goes rides down a curvy descent with a set of deep wheels on and goes back up and does it with just like a shallow set of spoked wheels. I mean, the shallow wheels feel and handle better, easier to change direction, don't get blown around as much, things like that. Of course, they're not as fast and sexy looking for the sponsors. But I think that looking at the aerodynamics is one teeny tiny part of it. But I really think that it goes more to the bikes themselves. One piece cockpits, you know, you're removing contact points for bars to flex within stems and things like that. And I think that the companies, from what I see and read, spend a lot of effort towards aerodynamics and towards stiffness for getting power out of a pedal stroke. But, you know, my background from motocross, even though I was a trainer, you know, I would go out with my riders on what they call test days, you know, where they're working on the chassis, something like that. And it's interesting being involved in dirt bikes, because when they're out there riding on a track, you know, nothing is about aerodynamics, or, you know, I wouldn't say not about power output, but there are, you know, there are body mechanics and stuff. But what I really would go out on test days and realize how many parts there are, you know, on a dirt bike, even more that can affect how a bike handles, from your tire casing to your rim, to the spokes you choose, to the through axle in your hub and how it flexes up your, you know, your fork. And so I think that if you look at modern road cycling, a lot of the trade-offs for going faster are removing a lot of those links in the chain that can help a rider have more feel with their bike. So, you know, I mean, I think they maybe have to do something, but I don't know exactly how much this is going to do towards the overall goal of eliminating, you know.
Yeah, you know, and I think the biggest part of this that I don't hear anybody addressing is the basic lack of skills of the riders, the new riders that are coming into the Pro Tour. You know, I mean, DS, you talk about, you know, a stiff wheel, right? Like, yeah. All these wheels now are made by machines. I mean, maybe there are some of these World Tour teams that are making hand-built wheels, but I don't think so. Or maybe the companies are doing them there. But the riders, I mean, I think, right, back to when we started, well, what'd you do in the winter? You rode cyclocross. Well, how come you rode cyclocross? Well, it was to help your bike handling, right, and to do some different type of, you know, training, but still to be on the bicycle. And it seems to me that the gorilla in the room, I mean, again, with these super rigid bikes, you know, one-piece cockpits, right? And then you read Paris-Roubaix Tech. Oh, we switched everybody to a bar and stem combos for Paris-Roubaix. Huh, I wonder why that is. Oh, well, it's more compliant, right? It's compliant on those cobbles when you're flat, but think when you're going down an uneven road and mountain road, right? And you hit something and that shock goes right up the front wheel through the fork, through the head tube, right into the handlebars, into the rider. And you've got a rider that's, you know, 125 pounds, you know, getting blown around like that. And they just don't have the skills to correct that. I mean, think of the first time you ever rode a deep front wheel and you got hit by a gust of wind. Yeah. Like, you know, probably had to go change your shorts.
And those deep wheels still handle bad, by the way. So it's just that everybody's got used to them. You know, they obviously do. They handle a little better. I'm not going to say that hasn't been a part of it. But when you read all the tech about the rims and everything, I never seem to read about handling. Yeah. It's about airflow. It's about this. They got a pressure gauge in there. But does any of them ever say, hey, we've worked on this 50 mil rim so it actually handles lighter through the corners and doesn't feel so cumbersome, you know? But you don't really hear that as much. Maybe they are doing it, but I would think that if they were, they would publicize that a bit.
Yeah. Well, last week's big press release was the new Revol wheels from Specialized. They went deeper on the front, shallower.
The mullet, right? They call it.
Shallower on the rear. And they went carbon spokes. And they're standing behind it. It's getting a lot of buzz. So.
Right. Yeah, we'll have to see. It'll be interesting to see if that front wheel handles better. Now, I didn't get to read through their press release on those wheels, or maybe if I did, I didn't see anything in there about handling, but maybe I missed that, right? It was more about aerodynamics. Now they're saying, it's funny how like in mountain biking, the mullet is a small back wheel, big front wheel, which I guess in a way it's the same way now as they're going with the deeper front, as that's your leading edge and it's more aerodynamic and the back wheel is so in the middle of the frame and with feet going around by it, right? That the air is pretty disrupted by the time it gets the back wheel. So a little bit lighter one accelerates quicker. That's kind of the thinking. Yeah, it will be interesting to see how big that gets.
Well, also for them, they don't have like a true aero bike. The SL8 is like the Tarmac is like a combo, you know, do everything bike.
Right.
It's actually pretty amazing in all the testing and all the rider feedback. But so their rear aerodynamics is a little different than Cervelo. Cervelo is, you know, really trying to flow that rear air. So what they designed for their bikes is a little different. I mean, that's probably the future, is the bikes, the wheels really being designed around each manufacturer's bike and what's best for that manufacturer's frame.
Right. If of course aerodynamics matter for you, which is a whole other topic, which for most people, the aerodynamics that they're selling you on doesn't.
It's a marketing ploy. You know, I was saying it'll be interesting to see, you know, they release these wheels. It'll be interesting to see when there's real world testing, right? I mean, sure, you'll have a bunch of people on the group ride saying how much faster they feel and how much better. But I mean, let's be realistic. You know, you talk about those deep wheels. I've gone down to the North Bay, you know, Marin County, or once in a while, do these group rides. And every time I get into a group with a bunch of people on deep wheels, I just
kind of back off another half a bike length with these people, you know? You ride in Sonoma County, the roads are what would be referred to as a gravel road in other counties with how rough they are and all of that stuff. And it's just like, yeah, it's frightening. And people, you know, there's a lot of, I've worked in marketing. There's a lot of truth in it and there's a lot of hype in it. And people need to be smart enough to figure out what actually matters to them, not what someone tells them matters to them.
Yeah. Well, just to follow back around on this, as of course the subjects, you know, we have all sorts of information to add. But as far as the aero rules, so the main three takeaways were it's gearing, right? Bar width. And then wasn't there a third part of it that I'm missing right now or not?
Gearing
and
bar.
Oh, and then the frame. Yes. Oh, rim depth. And then also like frame.
Frame.
Like the width of a fork cross sections. Yeah. For speed. And so I know that there was a meme that we had texted about at the beginning about how there were people that were saying that for smaller riders, the bar width standard was like unfair to them, you know, because they're small or something like that. But I think as that goes, you know, you start to get the point, well, then you say, but a smaller rider is more aero than a bigger rider because they're cutting a smaller hole. Or the one that I brought up is you could say based on a rider's size, having the bars a little bit narrower compared to their body size is unfair to them. But then again, for a smaller rider, they're still on 29 inch, you know, or 700C wheels, which compared to their body size is bigger. So is that an aerodynamic advantage for them? I just feel like for some things like bars, you just kind of have to pick a standard. This is our minimum width. You know, now the aerodynamic part is one thing. I think it will actually help for handling because the narrower your bars get, the harder they are to handle. So maybe, you know, maybe that side will help out a little bit with the handling. But I don't know what you guys think about that in terms of narrow bars. Kurt, you're closer to involved with, say, women's cycling. And I think some of the women were more the ones that, you know, that didn't like this, felt it was unfair to them. Know what your thoughts are on that?
Yeah, I mean, I just think any rider who has narrower shoulders and is smaller and generally, you know, within the women's peloton and the men's peloton, it does seem to adversely affect the women in that respect.
Yeah. That the wider bars are less aero for them compared to the size of their body.
Well, or just less ergonomically correct. I mean, when did we start? What'd you do? It's like, oh, how wide are your shoulders? I guess I'm too far, right? How wide are your shoulders? That's how wide your handlebars should be, right?
Oh, right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, it's
but
just,
do you think as there's any part is any narrow too narrow? Is there a point when it becomes too narrow? I mean, you know, can you say it's what's now? It's 38 center to center for the drops and 34 at the levers. Is that what it is? Or maybe it's 40 and 34 outside. So 38
and 32.
Outside. Yeah. Yeah,
30, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I like riding wide bars because they handle better. When I get into situations, I feel like I have more leverage. I think it does adversely affect smaller riders, you know, just ergonomically. I mean, imagine, right, if you've got narrow shoulders and you're having to reach out really far. It's like you went through that whole thing putting those flared bars on your gravel bike, trying it out, you know.
Super wide,
and at a certain point, it got to the point where it was too wide for you. I mean, think of it the opposite way.
Yeah. But is it an unfair, like, is it unfair to them? Like, that's what I'm saying. I think so.
Yeah. I think it's unfair to tell a small rider that they have to ride a wider bar, you know? I don't know how you get around that, right? So, if your shoulders are this wide, I mean, the UCI is going to come up with a shoulder jig, right?
Right.
Everyone, I mean, I think that the UCI often just tries to come up with a solution for something that hasn't been studied well enough. You know?
That's a for sure.
Yeah, that's a for sure. So,
yeah,
you know, I think the verdict is still out there on that. But I do think it's...
What do you think, Ed?
Well, I had this one thought that the young riders... I had a young German rider stay at my house for a Belgian waffle ride. He was probably in his early 20s. And, you know, he's kind of grew up on narrow bars, you know? So you suddenly put him on wide bars, he can't squeeze through the peloton the way he used to. So,
but I wonder how many people are running a bar narrower than a 40-44 or 38-32, whatever you want to call it. Like
Taco Vanderhorn,
Kappenarts. One of the best names in cycling.
Yeah. Well, they're at the far end of the bell curve. Yeah.
Yeah. A couple people. I mean, I guess you always have to pick, you know, it's just like they had how far forward can you bring your saddle? I guess they did have some anatomical exceptions for that.
Yeah.
But I feel like sometimes on hardware, it's kind of hard. You just have to pick a line, right? It's even like deep dish wheels. I mean, I'm sure there's people who could ride a 60 mil wheel as good as somebody can ride a 40, But you just got to say, all right, we're going to make it, you know, whatever, 50 or 60 mils. That's just the limit for everybody. I'm sure in some type of a hard limit like that, there'll be somebody in that curve that it's less or more advantageous for them.
The cool thing I have is I have these Canyon bars that are adjustable. So yeah. I could adjust them. You were saying something earlier that I wanted to get back to just a little bit is that, you know, I'm heavier and I have a lot of forward inertia and stuff. And I'm trying to get used to riding these modern road bikes really fast. I go on the Wednesday ride every once in a while through Camp Pendleton. And there's this one turn that goes underneath a little, you know, military underpass. And I was like, wow, I don't like the way my front wheel feels. You know, it's the stiff bike, it's the one-piece bar, but I'm also missing steel and the more drawn-out forks and stuff, you know?
Yeah.
And I just don't always totally feel safe. But one of the ways that I started to feel safer was riding 32 tires. And part of me wonders, like, you know, there's a lot of debate around, you know, Specialized had their opinions last week about tire width with the rims and so forth. I just really think 32 tires and maybe 34 tires make these really fast modern bikes more compliant, more tolerant, you can handle them better. And that's part of, you know, like that's part of where we're getting is that wide tires right. help us cope with these bikes.
Well, I mean, that new Continental tire that they came out with, they developed with UAE, the Antichrist, but it's called the Archetype, I think is the name of the tire. But, you know, they made that in a 30. So I think that's a pretty big statement.
Should have made a 32.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure there's something on the way, but you know, as far as what those guys are racing, I mean, you think about that, whatever year we're in 2025, I mean, at the big tires, I mean, who would have imagined, you know, even 3 or 4 years ago that the top tire would be a 30, you know, the best choice that they figured that out. I mean, that just seems enormous. I remember when I put 30s on my road bike, I couldn't believe going downhill. I just felt like I was, you know, on a slot car track. You have so much grip. It's amazing. But to think that that's also actually rolling faster is definitely an advancement of technology.
Hey Ed, are you riding tubeless or tubed setup?
Yeah, tubeless.
Tubeless. So then tubeless. You're also able to ride a lower pressure.
Yeah, it
took
me.
Which I think the proper pressure combined with the wider tires is the key, because you put a big old tire on and run it at 80 or 90 PSI and it's not gonna handle there. So I think that's a big thing, getting that.
Yeah,
tire guy's brain is going over there.
Yeah, me and tire pressure has been a hilarious journey. I'm like, because I came from 110, 100, yeah. 95, you know, and even recently, you know, it's taken me a while to adapt to these really low tubeless pressures on my road bike and even my mountain bike, but it's game changing. I had a nice conversation with my physical therapist yesterday and he's like, man, my hands are hurting. I changed my stem. Yeah. And I go, 45 PSI sounds like too much for your gravel bike. Like, take it down, you know? So
that's funny.
Yeah.
Definitely. Yeah. So yeah, the UCI rules. Well, it'll be interesting to see if it actually stops the crashes or not. My guess is it won't change much, but I've definitely been wrong before. So it'll be interesting to see how it plays out.
Well, one last thing about the, you know, every director sportif is in every rider's ear with a radio telling them move forward, and everybody can't move forward at the same time. And there's so much pressure with, you know, World Tour points and, you know, trying to keep your classification and, you know, there's so many factors, the radios, the road furniture. I think the promoters just, you know, I watched the early season races in the Middle East and like they didn't even have padding on the foam, on the power poles near the sprint. Like the promoters need to do a better job of making the road safer. So
and ultimately who does that come back to that approves the courses? The UCI, right? There's a fish, they're there, they say yes this is good or no this is not good, you know? And that's what it comes down to. And I think the low-hanging fruit is putting limitations on the bikes. The other stuff requires a lot more conversation with a lot more different stakeholders, personalities, this and that, where it's like, oh, well, we'll just bully the bike industry. And that's what happens. I mean, we've seen it for years. It's there are so many factors, way more factors that haven't been considered here.
Yeah.
But we definitely don't want to see people crash.
No, that's for sure.
Well, speaking of crashing, the first week of the Tour de France will be a survival in Brittany and on those narrow roads. Those roads in Brittany are very narrow. So
your old espresso roads.
So in future episodes, maybe we'll chat a little about the tour and other topics. We want to thank everyone for listening today. Make sure you like, follow, subscribe, share, find us on Substack, Instagram, YouTube. We'll be on all the podcast platforms as well. So share it with your friends and we welcome your feedback. We also, you know, have the ability to pull for some pretty amazing guests. So if people want to see guests, let us know if you want guests to appear on the show. So thank you very much for participating in episode one of the Service Course Report.
Yeah. Thanks for listening.
All right. Thanks, everybody.
Yeah. Wow.